Erikliyorum.
Hello and welcome to Impressions of America. I'm Simon, and with me as always are Toby and Vaughn. Hi guys.
Hi Simon.
Hi Simon.
Yes, we are back. After a long break, we have returned. Just like the specter of yet another Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, we are back and you can't stop us. And just like spending time with the Clintons, the last few months have been a busy and wild ride, including Toby's adventures with national elections in exotic locations around the world, and Vaughn's continued efforts to finish her PhD while doing every side quest possible. Yes, we are back and it should be a fun show. So Vaughn, do you want to introduce us to the topic at hand and maybe explain why we're covering this specific topic right now?
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about monopolization in Hollywood, my favorite subtopic that really has nothing to do with my PhD, but looks like it does. So I can talk about it as much as I want. But we're talking about monopolization because it's a serious issue at the moment. We're on the precipice of a very dangerous situation in Hollywood. And I know I've been saying that for years, but it's even worse now. And there are a few things that are looking very promising to fight back against it. And we'll get into that later. But that is the topic at hand, monopolization in Hollywood.
Yes, and I suppose the setting for this is that we are currently going through both a WGA strike right now, I think it's the last 4 months or so, and mm-hmm. we are going through a actor strike, which is having a big knock-on effect as far as the films that are being released, and maybe more to the point, the films that are getting pushed back as a result. And there's a whole range of topics that are kind of coming up in negotiations, which we'll probably get to later. And one of them is to do with how the streaming world has reshaped Hollywood and reshaped what it's meant for the sigils and things like that. So, yes, a very timely topic to go into. So, Vaughn, I don't know where you want to start with this. Do you want to just lead the way as you think best to go?
Yeah, well, right off of what you just said. So one of the biggest issues that we're talking about with the WGA strike is about residuals, which are the payments that writers and directors and producers and anyone involved in a production gets with the re-airing of a show or a film that is made. So if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I've been banging this drum for a long time about residuals and monopolization and all of these things. But for a quick recap of that, so residuals were first kind of considered in 1952 within Hollywood. Residuals were already a thing with the broadcasting companies and radio. It started in the 30s. Every time there's a new technological advancement, we have a discussion about residuals that really comes down to like a heated union battle, trying to get the studios to pay people appropriately for their work and their time. And the fact that the studios get to keep profiting off of re-airing things, they get licensing fees and advertising fees that the writers and directors and everyone involved should really be getting a cut of. So that's the conversation had about residuals. And in 1952, when television was really like starting up a bit, we had strikes that were led by the Screen Actors Guild's president, Ronald Reagan. And he returned in 1959 to head the negotiations for a second round of conversations about residuals for the Screen Actors Guild, and that turned into the 1960 strike that was also coinciding with the Writers Guild on strike. So the last time they have both struck together was 63 years ago in 1960 for the establishment of consistent residuals on films made within Hollywood and then aired on television. And there were also subsequent conversations around these strikes, considering actors who appeared in commercials and whether they had a right to residuals and all of these kinds of things. So bring that forward to right now, we're having another battle about all of these things, but specifically tied to streaming, most importantly. And that is really the crux of what we're going to talk about with monopolization, because in another thread on Twitter and an episode of Impressions from last year, we talked about the Paramount decision. And the Paramount decision, for those unfamiliar, was a Supreme Court decision that broke up the studio system on the basis of monopolization. So it was an antitrust decision that the studios had too much control over the production or the making of films, the distribution, the marketing of them, and exhibition, which would be showing them in a cinema. The Supreme Court decided that the eight major studios of the day had way too much control and were profiting obscene amounts of money while pushing independence out of the industry on both sides of production and exhibition. So they had to sign consent decrees to say that they would sell their cinemas. And that broke apart the studio system as it was, because the studios were relying on the massive funds that came from the most profitable end of vertical integration, which is those three parts of the making and marketing and showing a film. Exhibition is really the most profitable one. So when the studios lost that revenue, it crumbled the whole system, and we got a whole new kind of Hollywood come in. And that's why the 1960s are referred to as New Hollywood, because it's the knock-on effect of this 1948 Supreme Court decision that broke up the studios. They lost money, had to remodel their production models, and it ended up seriously benefiting independence. So that's what happened with Hollywood film. And we have this other background of 1960 coinciding with all of these kind of financial effects of the Paramount decision with the strikes led by Ronald Reagan, of all fucking people. And that's the kind of very condensed history bringing us up to how we understand film and residuals kind of now.
On residuals, if you could go back for me, Aaron Paul just released a video when he was talking about, you know, Netflix putting out more Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad actually spiking in views, and him feeling bad that he didn't get residuals from that. What do you think is the philosophical basis for residuals? Just because, you know, other people who work, you know, there are sort of downstream and long-term benefits from their work, but they aren't so obvious as it would be with an actor or a musician. So what do you think is the philosophical basis for getting residuals for labor?
So it's a good question, and one that comes up a lot, especially on the internet, with regard to these strikes and residuals and whether they're like warranted to be paid for their labor multiple times. I would say philosophically, that's a difficult question to answer because it's such a unique situation in Hollywood. But the overall answer, I guess, would be that if someone unrelated to the work is profiting off of your work, you deserve to be paid for it. They have to loop you in for that because you should own your likeness and your work.
No, I definitely agree. You know, it's like musicians owning their masters, right? And being able to get money from their work, you know, afterwards. They're stakeholders essentially in their work with the corporations, with the distributors that make it available for them. But it is, I can see it, but it's just, other people don't really have access to this kind of reward, I suppose. So I think only if they had shares in a company or something like that. It's quite an interesting thing.
I do hear that. I think it's very specific to creatives, how this functions, because you're creating it from scratch. Writers writing anything, not just screenplays, but writers and directors, producers, people creating music, people creating art have much more stake in the product that they made. And I do think it's right that the studios should get some of the money, because a lot of them, or well, all of them will be providing the resources and the financial backing. And like, they are also part of the production. It's inextricable at that point, but they're part of it. They shouldn't be getting the full amount of it.
I think there's also another element potentially of just how the market operates as well. So like, if you're a writer, for instance, you could go months without employment between sort of gigs where you're taking on you know, freelance work, essentially. And you hear this with actors as well, where a small paycheck that might literally keep them, you know, being able to afford food for the week or for the month from something they did 6 months ago, while they're jobbing, trying to get different, you know, try and get a new job elsewhere. And you know, I think Kevin Bacon came out and said, you know, he's one of the, you know, the 1% of actors who doesn't have to live on sort of paycheck to paycheck and doesn't have to worry about, you know, something that he did, you know, 5 years ago, keeping him and his family fed and things like that. Whereas for writers and for actors, that's very much not the case. And they are earning a relative pittance, actually, in comparison to what the studios are making. And they don't have a steady stream of employment. And if you compare something like the sector I worked in, which is software development, which, again, you could take the same approach and you say, well, you know, the software developer wrote some code that now allowed a new product to be available on a website, and now that company is making billions from it. And I do understand, you could say, there's a why isn't the, you know, the coder continuously getting money for his code? I guess from my perspective, they are, if you're a software developer, you know, you're pretty well paid and most likely in a sort of steady stream of work, you know, with a monthly paycheck and things like that. And so there is a different operation between someone who's creating something with a steady paycheck and sort of continuously adding to an existing product available on a website, to say something like, you know, creating a piece of art. So I guess that's the way I try and separate the two, but it is an interesting distinction, because it's like, well, you know, if I create something that has a lot of value, why am I not getting paid for it? And maybe the argument should be less, why isn't, you know, why does a writer deserve this paycheck? Maybe the argument instead should be, why doesn't the software developer deserve, you know, some sort of long-term pay down the line for this kind of thing instead? But that's, you know, a larger philosophical debate on labor.
And a communistic one. I agree with all of that, though. And for sure, that's the other side of it, is that they aren't paid sometimes at all, or well, at least. Like, it's a massive strike that we are having right now because of all of these issues coinciding, that they get paid absolutely nothing. A lot of people have this misconception of Hollywood that if you work for Hollywood, you're obviously glitz and glamour and making all the money. But even the biggest stars, well, some of them at least, will acknowledge, like, I waited tables for 10 years while I was your favorite character. Like, Sydney Sweeney last year had a huge story in the news that she couldn't afford her rent in LA, even though she's on Euphoria, which is one of the biggest shows that HBO had at the time, one of the biggest shows on television at the time. And she couldn't afford rent. And these are all problems that are industry specific, but then also wider in the country on multiple levels. Like, why is rent so expensive that you can't afford it in LA? Why are industries fighting with each other because, like, why do they get residuals and I don't? Like, these are all, like, massive kind of questions that need addressing in the country. And thankfully, we are in one of the largest labor movements since the last two major movements in the 80s and the 40s, which is interesting that it's every kind of 40 years, every two-ish generations are like, absolutely fucking not, let's address these things, because this is out of hand and ridiculous.
I think what's also sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say one thing that if you picked up any of the detail around some of the requests that writers have been asking for in their strikes, one of the things they've been asking for is actually to get paid on time. And the studios have flat out refused to say no. Like we're happy taking fines on this. Like there was a statement released with like the requests from the writers. I think it was as far as you know to do with AI or to do with pain or to do with working conditions and writers' rooms and that kind of stuff. And one of the things they asked for was to be paid on time, and the response was back. It was something like lines of like, no, we'll just pay the fines instead or something like that. So we are dealing with an industry that at the very basics of like paying labor, like paying people on time, isn't even a condition they're willing to work with right now. So we are so far away from like, you know, like normal working conditions that we do have certain special factors in play as far as residuals and that kind of stuff.
Just before you get on to more serious shit, the one example was like Sean William, who played Steve Stifler on American Pie. He actually had to work at a zoo after he made the movie. I think he made like $8,000 for making the movie, and he sold churros at a zoo in the few months after making the movie.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it is astonishing how much or how little people in certain industries will get paid. And then you compare that to, you know, someone like a YouTuber, for instance, who maybe has a few million views on a YouTube video every time they upload it, and maybe they earn a few $1,000s, but they can do that kind of continuously on their own. You know, they can do that daily if they want. And actually, the mechanisms for being a YouTuber for many people might be a lot more profitable than you know, writing a hit show or appearing in a hit show. It is quite extraordinary.
It's fucking terrible, actually, because... I have to admit this, that I actually became a Patreon of a reaction YouTube show. So these people are reacting to The Wire, and I'm just watching it, and they're just reacting to it. And, you know, they might be getting more money than some of the actors on The Wire, you know?
It is a as Vaughn said, it's a fascinating time to be living through, you know, the financial implications of, lack of a better term, creating content, and how... there are now more channels available, and how for some of those, you know, as far as, you know, YouTube or OnlyFans or even Twitter, that there might be a possibility of earning more money through, you know, writing a funny tweet or sending a GIF or reacting to The Wire than there would be in actually spending months or years of your time creating a show that's a relative hit that is liked by the critics, and then, you know, you're selling churros on the side of a zoo in order to move on to your next project.
It really is a catastrophe at the moment. Everything's really messy in Hollywood and with YouTube at the moment as well. Like in November last year, November 2022, YouTube users who are backed by Google sued Disney for antitrust violations in how they bundle ESPN with their other streamers. And if you've noticed, if you have kind of Disney Plus or Amazon or Paramount or any of these kind of like main hub ones, you can buy extension subscriptions through your main one. And that is becoming like the old system of cable bundling that we had in the 2000s. And Disney was sued for this exact same antitrust violation then for how they bundled ESPN with other channels. So we're having this like repeat of monopolization issues because they can, and they just end up having to pay a fine for it. And with YouTube, I think we're getting to a point where we're gonna have to have like unions for YouTube creators and government regulations on YouTube, because some of the kind of horror stories that you hear about, especially parents using their children for content on YouTube, or people being cheated out of their like rightful money or any sorts of these things, like YouTube censoring people for saying certain words on YouTube. They're like, we're going to need some regulation there as well, but we desperately need it in Hollywood, which I will bang that drum for the rest of time. We desperately need antitrust legislation in Hollywood. And this harkens back to a different antitrust history with television that kind of mirrors the Paramount one in 1948. So in 1970, the FCC stepped into television and established the financial interest and syndication rules, which is FinCEN. I'm going to refer to it as FinCEN, but that's what it means. So we had three main contributors to television. The three main networks were the National Broadcasting Company, American Broadcasting Company, and Columbia Broadcasting System, which you know as NBC, ABC, and CBS. All of them were originally radio broadcasting companies. NBC and CBS were both established in 1927, and ABC was a subsidiary of NBC that broke off to be independent in 1943. So these three like jumped at the chance to get onto television because they had all of the broadcasting capabilities. They kind of knew what they were doing with live productions more than the Hollywood studios. So that's why Hollywood kind of slowly got into syndicated television. And they also weren't allowed to own their own exhibition networks because of the Paramount decision. So it allowed ABC, NBC, and CBS to air their shows as syndicated television. Syndicated television is when you have a show, you make a show that isn't specifically tied to a network, so it can be licensed out to multiple networks or shown on other channels, whatnot. So the studios are making syndicated television between the 40s and the late 80s. NBC, ABC, and CBS are making their own shows and also making their own syndicated shows and start creating their own subsidiary networks or like network affiliates so that they can show their own shows at different times on all of their channels and kind of rake in profits from advertising, from licensing, all of these things. So they're really modeling the studio system that was broken up in 48. They have their production model, they have distribution, and they have exhibition, all in-house and profiting kind of in circles. So the FCC is like, we can't allow this, and establishes FinCEN. And what FinCEN does is two things. Two main things. So the first one is it ends perpetual financial interest in shows beyond the first run. So this is the idea that the like CBS, if they make a show and they run it the first time, they can keep all of the profits from that. But if it's shown like 10 more times after that on the same network, then they cannot profit from that. So they can't just have like forever reruns on a show. The second thing is banning the formation of in-house syndication arms. So they're not allowed to make any more networks, any more subsidiaries, any more affiliates where they can then show their shows and continue to profit in that same way. In 1971, a year after FinCEN, we got the primetime access rules. And this limited to 50% the amount of primetime shows with financial affiliation to the airing network. So that was the idea that like on NBC, on any given night, they could only show 50%. For 50% of the time, they could only show their own shows. The other 50% had to be acquired from an independent or another network. So,
Vaughn, could you just very briefly, why do you think it took so long if the breaking up of the studio system happened in 48. Why did the the government wait 20 years?
So the development of television is a bit different from Hollywood. So Hollywood was going through all of these issues financially and really struggling to kind of get a foothold in television with their syndicated television. And the broadcasting companies were airing things live for a lot of the time. And then when they could start using pre-recorded shows in like the late 50s, I want to say, I think it was 56. That's when we started having issues with residuals and the strikes in 1960. There was a subsequent negotiation kind of issue in 62. So like this, the television arms of Hollywood and the broadcasting companies through the whole of the 60s are kind of struggling against each other and struggling in their own ways with establishing television as a foothold. They're having issues with unions, and they're also having kind of lawsuits about all of these things. And then it comes to a head in 1970 with the FCC establishing FinCEN. So it's not that it wasn't addressed. It's that they were trying to figure out how to address it properly for this whole period, as they were recognizing that the studios and the broadcasting companies were consolidating into these vertically integrated kind of mimics of the studios pre-1948. Does that make sense?
No, yes, absolutely. Yeah, from what I gather, it seems like they didn't really understand the system, even though the political will might have been there. They just simply didn't understand the system until the late 60s, and then they enacted the rule in 1970.
Yeah, there were just so many issues happening and so many changes in the whole of entertainment media anyway. So in the 60s with film, we get New Hollywood, and that's when all of the independents are really rising up and challenging the Hays Code, especially with even more vigor. So in 1968, we get the rating system come in. So there's a lot of like moving parts in the 60s around all of the production of television and film. And television does work a little bit differently from the kind of established Hollywood system. So I think it was just so many changes happening within that one decade that it took so long to be like, oh, we need to enact actual antitrust kind of busting rules for these broadcasting companies to follow. And that is really why we're talking about it right now too, because that's the point that we're at with streaming, is that we've known for years, and we've been talking about it for years, that we need some sort of antitrust legislation or rules or interruption, some decision, whatever legal department is going to do it. We need someone to step in and establish some rules for the streamers. And it's getting to a head of, if we don't, it's going to take a very long time to untangle what is happening with streaming, with all of the studios just in the last year or two popping up with their own streaming sites. Like, I've lost track of all of the sites that are now available. So many shows that I could have watched on Amazon Prime with subscription or on Disney Plus with subscription are now like, oh, if you want to watch this show that you've watched here before, now you have to pay $7.99 a month for Paramount Plus or Showtime Plus or whatever. Like, they've all popped up in the last year or so. And it's, one, fucking frustrating, but two, a massive issue that is the same reason cable busted a decade ago, because nobody wants to pay for 15 or 20 different subscription services just to have access to all of the things they want to watch. And especially with streamers now cutting down on password sharing, like Netflix has done so evilly this year, while raising their prices, it's getting untenable. And we're getting to a point where we need this antitrust legislation. So I think that's the same kind of reason why it didn't happen until 1970. It's that we're all aware, but it takes some time for our systems to react and to put these things in place and to decide what things need to be put in place. It's a very complicated system, how all of this works. And it even was then, with it being a fairly new industry. So
FinCEN was close enough to the Paramount decrees that they had to sign decrees to the DOJ in 1977 to solidify their antitrust commitment. But like now you go into, if you go into the late 70s and into the 80s, now you're starting to see a movement against antitrust in the wider American federal system. You have books like The Antitrust Paradox that come out, purport to show that monopolies are actually better for pricing and than even competition and better for consumers and all this stuff. And there are challenges to this, challenges to FinCEN. How did the challenge go?
So the primary challenges were those kinds of philosophical ideas around the efficacy of antitrust legislation. They said that actually this was harming independence more than it was helping them. The kind of main push was that it's extremely expensive to make or exhibit a show. The production end and the exhibition end are both extremely expensive, and trying to find a network that will air an already created show is even more expensive for just like an independent producer and director and writer. If you just make a show that's extremely low budget, trying to get it aired on a network television was nearly impossible. And even with these rules in place where the networks had to seek out 50% of their primetime from other sources, the challenge to FinCEN was that, like, on the face, that sounds like it would be good for independence, but actually it's giving them false hope, and it's just going to, like, keep it all cyclical within these networks anyway and drive prices up even more for independents who are trying to get into the business. None of those were true. Like, it did help. Like, there's still kind of challenges to FinCEN today, people who make arguments for it, and it really comes down to your kind of economic philosophy around antitrust, I think. But in my view, same as with the Paramount decision, which again, a lot of film historians think is not that important to Hollywood history, and I think that they are wrong. That's just where we land on the debate. But as with the Paramount decrees and as with FinCEN, I think any antitrust legislation or antitrust busting actions from the feds is extremely helpful for independence. And we have established history of that from the 50s and 60s and the 80s and 90s. And then we also have the kind of ultimate trump card on that, not to use the name, but the ultimate trump card is that in 95, the FinCEN rules were eliminated because of these challenges and because of the ideas from the 80s being disseminated through this philosophy that antitrust isn't efficient. It's not doing what it claims to do, that monopolies and trickle-down economics actually fucking work. And interestingly enough, Ronald Reagan fought to keep these antitrust measures in place. As a former actor, he had a soft spot for television, because that's where he really got his gains, was with GE on television in the late 50s and 60s. So he fought against repealing these antitrust measures. Fucking wild. But then in 1995, when they were eliminated, we immediately had problems, and we have never addressed them since. So Fox had been establishing since the mid 80s, and we can get more into that in a moment, but Fox had been establishing their fourth network. Disney straight up bought ABC because they could. They were flush with cash, and they just bought it for, I believe, $19 billion in 1995. And that caused them to become vertically integrated. WB and Paramount both acquired television stations to establish their own networks in the 90s. Like, we immediately, as soon as the rules were repealed, had issues with production, distribution, and exhibition merging back together into vertical integration. And we didn't do anything to break it up. And now we're having the problems of the Paramount decrees that were repealed in 2020 and effectively were repealed in 2022 after a 2-year sunsetting period. We have the merging of the repeal of those and the like kind of haunting history that we never did anything about FinCEN 30 years ago when that was repealed, kind of merging into streaming where television and film really meet on the same platforms.
Okay, Vaughn, so you've been segueing into it, but why do you think regulators and legislators have regretted the cancelling of FinCEN in the last few years? And what do you think is the push towards new antitrust legislation in recent times?
So that's really like the heart of this issue. In the last 10 years, well, 10 years ago in 2013, we had kind of catastrophic conversations about antitrust where there was the merger of Ticketmaster and Live Nation that was allowed by the DOJ. And it really should not have been. That is in the same kind of way that we're talking about here, the people selling the tickets and the people who own the venues merging together as one company and owning over 80%, I think it's about 81% of the ticketing and venue kind of market for concerts or games or like sporting events, anything that you would go to like a concert venue for. So with that merger, and then with the Trump administration, who or which was all about deregulation and allowing monopolization, surprise, surprise. We had the repeal of the Paramount decision and this kind of renewed idea from the 80s that antitrust would fix everything. Now, we've been really lax, really, really lax, even under Obama and Bush about antitrust legislation in the 21st century. So you have industries like the airline industry, where all of these like major airline companies are buying up the smaller subsidiary kind of domestic ones or even international ones that are like the discount routes and either shutting them down or tacking on so many fees that even the discounted airlines become exorbitantly expensive. And they can do that because it's a monopoly. Like, they don't have any competition. You're going to pay it. If you have to get a flight somewhere, you're going to pay the price that is listed because the train lines are doing the same thing and they're also extremely expensive. And we don't invest in infrastructure or public transit enough to make these things worth it. So our kind of laxed view of antitrust for about 20 years is really biting us in the ass, especially with entertainment industries, because now, like, Disney, Amazon, Netflix, like, all of these studios aren't just studios anymore. They're not just producing things. They're also owning theme parks and massive publication companies or news outlets. Like the fact that Disney owns ABC and has for almost 30 years should be really scary, because that's a trusted news source in the US, as is the Washington Post, which is owned by Amazon. We have these like massive kind of conglomerates now that are running our entertainment media as well as our news media. So there are so many issues here. It's hard to like pick which one I really want to focus on. But the main one, in my opinion, for Hollywood especially, that needs to be broken up is that the studios should not be able to own their own streaming platforms. And that now includes Netflix, because Netflix exploited their position and started producing their own content for their platform in the early 2010s, after establishing the platform in 2007. And that kind of corrupted their business into a vertically integrated one. So all of these streamers have their own financial stakes in the original content that they put on their platforms, and can decide then the pay for people for them. And also the residuals get really funny when it's like they're far lower when it's an in-house production, because there's no licensing fee generally for those kinds of productions. So they can get away with paying less in salary, and they can get away with paying less in residuals if they have in-house productions. And they can also pull content from other streamers, which is why, like Paramount, when they established theirs and they stripped all of their massive catalog from all of the other streaming services, things kind of sucked for a while on all of those other platforms, because Paramount then took all of their shows back and started exhibiting them themselves. And that's why we now have the extension branches on something like Amazon, or yeah, Amazon Prime, where you can buy the add-on of Paramount Plus and all of these like hundreds of platforms that now exist just to watch fucking shows. And it really needs to be regulated to like four or five main competing ones that don't have financial stakes in the production of the shows that are being exhibited. We have to delineate between the branches of production, distribution, and exhibition. We cannot have vertically integrated media. And we know this because we've been through it twice now in very recent history.
Like, so 48, I have a... Oh, sorry, you go on.
I was just going to say, 48 was, what, 75 years ago? 75 years ago is when the Paramount decision broke up the studios, and we have had another round since then of antitrust action against vertical integration with entertainment media. And we're now talking about it again. And it's just like, we can't keep repealing these things. They just need to be separate.
I was going to ask, because I think what maybe a lot of people don't realize is just how unprofitable streaming is right now for the vast majority of the streamers out there. I think Netflix is now making some money, but for a long time and had to operate under a loss, and these streaming services in general are not making money for streamers. They are essentially the other parts of the business that have sort of propped up the streaming side of it. So obviously Amazon is a massive company that doesn't need streaming to make money, in the sense that if it's sort of bringing people to, you know, Amazon in general, and it's sort of an add-on of their platform, and they can potentially, you know, integrate ads on the streaming site into, you know, the actual Amazon platform to then sell you things. There's obviously a lot of things going on there. Same for Apple right now, which Apple has, you know, got huge resources of money, and it kind of doesn't matter to a certain extent if it's losing money or spending a lot of money on certain things. It's got into broadcasting sports, for instance, in a way that it hasn't done before. And it's not, you know, making huge, it's not making money off the MLS rights that they bought, that they paid, I think it was $2 billion for, or something like that. But is a way for them to potentially platform that they can, you know, broadcast live sports. So potentially further down the line, they can get rights to NBA games, for instance, and things like that. And maybe they can build out the kind of line of what Apple TV is. And you kind of go down the line, you know, these streamers are by themselves not making money. And actually the old financial sort of cable packages were much more profitable for companies than the streamers have been so far. And I think what will be interesting is how this will either naturally come to a head, or as you say, if there's antitrust legislation that comes about that moves certain goalposts on these things. But David Zaslav, who's in charge of HBO Discovery, is that what it's called these days? Or Warner Brothers Discovery. They've essentially been licensing off very recently a bunch of different media, you know, Batman and other such content that they have. Suits, I think, is one that got licensed out, which is now like the biggest streaming show on Netflix, even though it's an old show. Like you have these business models which are kind of fluctuating as a result of people not being able to make the money directly on their platforms and having to potentially just license out their content instead. I think Sony is an example of a company that hasn't gone down the streaming route and instead has partnered with other companies, such as Netflix, to just stream their content. And I do wonder at what point we will either get that change from a legislative point of view or from a market point of view, where, you know, at some point, you know, Paramount is tired of losing money or whatever the case is, because right now that is something which is hitting them. But for companies like Amazon and Apple, they obviously have all the money in the world and it doesn't matter as much. Whether or not that will change for other companies like Paramount, who don't have an Apple style company behind them, we don't know. And of course, the other factor in all this is what companies may buy out the other. So like the long-standing rumor has been that Apple will eventually buy Disney. And if that happens, then obviously that would unite a lot of streaming content under one place. So fascinating to think what might happen. You know, the Hulu side of things, I think, is about 75% owned by Disney and 25% owned by someone else. I can't remember off the top of my head. And so there's discussions on whether that will be wholly bought by Disney so they can just purely platform Hulu into the US version of Disney Plus. Because right now, for instance, we live in the UK, we get a lot of the content that of Hulu either on Disney Plus itself or on other platforms such as Amazon, and we don't Amazon Prime, and we're not having to pay that additional Hulu pricing. So there's a bunch of really interesting stuff that could happen with this, and I think the continued losses on streaming may hit ahead, and we may, you know, see either more licensing deals that happen, or we may eventually see more, you know, large takeover deals or migration deals as a result of this kind of thing.
Simon, what you said is insane. I feel like my brain is melting. So is there a streaming service that is making money, or has it always been a barren?
Netflix wasn't making money for a long time, but yeah, its share prices were going up. I think Vaughn can correct me on this. I think Netflix now is turning a profit. I think in part because they've ramped down their production costs and they've been able to grow without having spent quite so much on sort of the film and television side of things, on just a production level. But my understanding of this is that streaming by itself is not particularly profitable, and Disney, for instance, have been losing money over hand over fist for years, just trying to grow this brand. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of this stuff, both on streaming and the cable packages and how sports rights things play out. I mean, you know, the streaming, sorry, the old pack, the old bundles of things like ABC and ESPN used to kind of come bundled together and things like that. You actually look at the numbers of subscribers to ESPN now is drastically reduced as a result of well, less need for it essentially, because there's less bundling of cable packages and things like that. So, you know, there's even been rumors that Disney might decide to just sell off ESPN at some point in order to do other things with that money. It's probably not going to be anytime soon, but there's a whole possible route of things like that, that could happen. But yes, to answer your point, to answer your question, Toby, my understanding is that basically no one is making money off streaming right now, and it's almost a future bet on what the platform will be outside of Netflix, which now is.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah,
that's right. A lot of it's also like, it's really complicated. If you look at the quarterly earnings sheets from studios, which are all public on their websites, you can just Google the quarterly earnings for them. They're really interesting to read. Disney's is the hardest to read. They make it really difficult. But like WB, their recent one was all in pink for Barbie. Like they do nice quarterly earnings for sheets. But if you look at specifically the streaming platform sections with how much they spend and how much they actually make, it's almost always negative for the total. Like
I was reading an article here that says, on the whole, major streaming services from Disney Plus, NBC Universal, Paramount, and Warner Brothers Discovery have reported total combined losses in excess of $18 billion since 2020.
Yeah. Like, it's extremely expensive to run a streaming service. And think about it, the only thing that we're paying for, especially for the ones that don't have ads, the only thing we're paying is like $7.99 a month. So it's like a great deal for the consumer at the moment, but it's not a great deal for the studios or the people creating the content. I hate calling films and movies content, creating the things that we're watching on these streaming platforms.
I wonder why that is. Is it because they can't get enough people to pay the subscription, because they obviously are direct and easy alternatives to this? It almost seems like if this is true, essentially they just made their content a public good and gaining next to no benefit apart from maybe some equation somewhere that says, well, you can increase your share price if you have a streaming service.
There's probably a combination of factors as far as like some that might be, you know, so you've got like the Amazon and Apple side of things, which they don't care about burning money if it means that they can help further their brand and continue making money elsewhere. So they almost feel like a separate part of this compared to like the old studio type, you know, like the Warner Brothers and Disney type things that don't have as much resource coming in from elsewhere. Obviously, you know, Disney have money coming in from a variety of different things, but it's not quite the same as Amazon or Apple. I think one of the things that you've got right now is whether or not those types of companies will continue to build into it, and whether or not, I mean, Netflix is now looking more and more at the pricing model around advertising. I think they've now introduced that, and that might be a continued goal for them to essentially allow them to grow and offer a cheaper deal to customers who maybe don't want to spend $20 a month, but are okay paying $7.99 a month, as long as, you know, they then get adverts included. So it's possible that we will see more tiers to this that involve advertising, at which point streaming services have essentially just become cable television again. So it's basically what they're trying to get back to is the winning cable services of about 20 years ago. But as with a lot of these things, technology has ruled the 21st century as far as media is concerned. And Netflix, I think, often position themselves as a technology company rather than as a content or media company. And
that's also for legal protections.
Sure. So there you go. So like the advancement of being able to stream on demand content has opened up a world in which, you know, waiting 3 days for a TV episode to come around because you haven't seen it in 6 years is just not acceptable to a user who can go to another service and be like, well, I'll just stream my favorite film at any point I wanted. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So the advertising thing is definitely something that's coming, but another thing is what you touched on with Apple and Amazon. And I'm going to throw in Disney as well. They're all horizontal companies. Like, they're like, streaming isn't their whole thing. They have other revenue from other things. Disney wields their IP. So they have the parks, they have the publishing and books and shit, all of those things. They have television and film. And then they also have like physical merchandise. So all of your like shirts and collectible boxes and toys and everything. Like, they have so many other ways of making money. So the streaming service is really subsidiary to those things for Disney, where it kind of reminds you why you love Disney, and then like gets your kids to want to go to Disney, and like your whole life becomes Disney, especially if you have children and Disney Plus. With Amazon and Apple, it's again subsidiary to the rest of their things. Apple, at least, you can only have, like, you can just buy an Apple Plus, Apple TV Plus subscription, and it's fairly cheap. It's one of the cheapest ones on the market, I think, right now. And you can stay just within that realm. But if you have every other kind of Apple product and everything, then it's all integrated and you can watch it across platforms and whatnot. Amazon, like, you can't even just subscribe to Prime Video, I'm pretty sure. You have to have a Prime membership, and then you get all of these like perks and benefits and things, which include your Prime Day free shipping and Prime Video. So like, it's all integrated horizontally as like, this is the whole kind of package, the whole service that we provide. Netflix is the one that kind of stands out here as having the hardest time with all these things, but they are starting to grow horizontally. So all of them are integrating ads, but Netflix is like learning from the other models. And last year they purchased 3 video game studios. So they are trying to get into the video game market. And that might be with like, you'd then be streaming your games straight from Netflix, or it might be like mobile games that go along with the shows that you're watching, like Stranger Things. I think one of the studios that they bought makes the mobile game for Stranger Things, or it could be actual physical, like you're buying the game from the store. I don't even know if people do that anymore. I don't play video games. Is GameStop still a thing? I don't even know. But like, they're branching into a horizontal industry as well. Sorry, Simon, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say the video game thing will be interesting, because like, Google tried essentially something similar like this with Google Stadia, I think it was called, that failed and is now dead. But they obviously didn't have the kind of platform that Netflix does, where it's kind of freely available. Now, whether or not people will want to integrate that in the same way, and what the experience is on a mobile device compared to a TV device and things like that, I guess is to be determined. I would be fascinated to know. And one of the things that I'm sure Vaughn will get to is that one of the things with Netflix and other companies like this is we have no way of being able to tell what is popular, which is obviously intentional as far as being able to, you know, get residuals and that kind of stuff. But I certainly have no idea as to when I look on, because you can see games on Netflix, and I have no idea if that's popular at all and whether or not there is a genuine market for that. But the fact that Netflix have been able to at least make that start on it is an interesting move. And whether or not Netflix do other things such as start streaming live events, you know, award shows, who knows, 5 years from now, maybe the Oscars are streamed on Netflix. Maybe in 20 years' time, all live sports are just purely streamed on video on demand services is, I guess we'll see.
We'll definitely see. Something is going to change very soon. Whether it's like streaming busts entirely, or we have a return to physical media. A lot of people are demanding a return to physical media because the streamers can just strip your favorite shows or strip shows that have only been on for like a couple months, just knock them off and take a tax break on them. That they're just gone forever. Like they just don't exist anymore because the streamers never made, or the studios never made a physical copy of it. And for distribution, obviously there's like a physical copy in the studio, but there isn't one for distribution. So like, a lot of people are calling for this. Even Matt Damon was talking about it on his Hot Ones episode, like earlier this year, I think, or last year. They need physical media to come back, because with DVD sales or like Blu-ray sales or VHS or whatever era you want to go to, there was a straightforward, like, we sold X number of DVDs, so therefore the writers and actors and directors and shit, that everybody gets this predetermined number for residuals. Like that is a simple model where we can understand things, and it's not reliant on the streamers saying exactly how many subscribers they have. We've had so many issues, so many goddamn issues with like Amazon and Netflix just straight up lying about the number of subscribers they have, or just straight up not paying residuals, not alerting the unions that they need to pay out X amount from the streamers. Like, it comes down to an honor system pretty much until the WGA gets the National Labor Relations Board involved, the NLRB, and they force Amazon or Netflix to give the real numbers. Like, streaming is such a fucking issue in so many
Amazon directions. And Netflix sounds like the Chinese government almost, you know, just putting out these fake numbers about everything. I feel like this is one of the, well, it could have been, you know, maybe 10 years ago, the impetus for maybe NFTs, because blockchain technology was always, the dream was always that, because it's an authentication thing, people can't distribute things that you don't want them to distribute. So we can have an effective single sale of something. And but I mean, it's come under some criticism recently because of the NFTs and the carbon footprint that NFTs create. But way back when, I think it probably could have been a solution in basically re-monetizing the internet, because it does seem like, I mean, given this reality with streaming services, that this content is effectively being used as a public good with a very, very small barrier to entry of subscription that can be dismissed anyway, because the alternatives to it are very easily accessible. It does seem like a pretty dire situation for the companies. I know with NFTs, Quentin Tarantino recently released some scenes, some extra scenes from Pulp Fiction on an NFT, but I think the rights were violated, so he had to go to a legal court case because of it. But yeah, it does seem like more and more people are trying to recreate, you know, the old system of reward for their media, and it goes beyond Pharrell getting like a few thousand for a big song like Get Lucky. It does seem like physical media was probably a better system for rewarding the work.
It absolutely was. And I don't know much about NFTs or how they work or anything, but I know DVDs, and it was just a better system. Relying on the internet, especially when we have like power grids going down constantly and like servers just kind of blowing up because of climate change that they're adding to and all of these things, like a lot of this shit is going to be wiped out forever eventually. Like if we do nothing about climate change and we just keep fucking with the internet and like making all of these servers everywhere that draw so much fucking electricity and add to climate change perpetually, like we're going to lose the internet one day.
Are you saying, Vaughn, that focusing on short-term corporate profits might not necessarily be a long-term strategy for the human race?
I do think that might be what I'm saying, Simon.
Oh, okay.
Just want to ask a quick question about like motive in terms of just to get back to monopolization, because yeah. I think I remember in the 1980s, the monopolization wave was spurred on not just by, you know, big fat cat companies wanting to rule everything, but also like by the stock market. So you had a lot of lawyers and private equity professionals who loved mergers because that was when they got paid a lot. Mm-hmm. But what do you think is the motivation? And has anyone really talked to people at Disney or at Apple about their motivations for, you know, monopolization? I mean, I suppose the tradition goes all the way back to, and probably even further, but all the way back to Standard Oil and, you know, the rail and oil trusts of the early 1900s.
It's a good question. I don't know what their answer would be. Probably some sanitized, like, diplomatic legal answer where they're not implicating themselves. But if I had to guess what their reasons were, it's greed and power, especially, mm-hmm. especially with entertainment and cultural media. Like, if you own what this is another thing I'll keep yammering on about forever. We cannot allow our cultural media to be run by four guys. Like, we just cannot allow this. If you have, like, if four is an exaggeration, but 50 is not. In 1947, there were 50 Hollywood executives who met in the Waldorf Astoria in New York after the House Committee on Un-American Activities subpoenaed the Hollywood 10 and then found them in contempt of Congress. In November of 1947, 50 Hollywood executives met and established the Waldorf Astoria statement, which established the blacklist and said, we just won't hire anyone who has any ties to any communist or subversive groups. The vaguest fucking statement, and kowtowing this political line that was started by HUAC and the federal government being afraid of the Reds again. That was even before McCarthyism. 47 is before McCarthyism starts. Like, that is a fucking issue if like 50 people get to decide what everyone in the US and anyone who's watching exported content around the world gets to know or see about Hollywood and American culture. Like, we cannot allow that to happen again. And that is only a very small part of the reason that, like, the financials were the main part for the Paramount decision and everything being broken up, but it was one of the most important implications that 50 people didn't get to make those decisions anymore. And that's why we had an independent rise in the 60s with all of these new experimental surrealist films and ideas that incorporated like global views and global cinema and like Kubrick. If we're talking 2001 A Space Odyssey, the original of that is, I believe, a Czech film called Ikari. Is it Ikari? I've seen it. It's fantastic. It's even better than 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, that's where Kubrick got his ideas from. We have this amazing interplay with other countries that at the time, earlier than that, never would have been allowed because they were communist or they had communist connections. Or the Soviets were doing fucking horrible things to them, but we turned a blind eye. Like, and that was stifled by 50 people. Right now, we're in another situation where these conglomerates are run by people whose names we know. Like, we all know Zaslav. He runs WB. And Iger is the head of Disney right now. Like, we're aware of these people. And we just casually say, like, oh, yeah, these, like, six people are holding up the entire writer's strike. There are tens of thousands of people on strike right now because of these six people. Like, that's a problem that we really need to address because they get to make the decisions, the ultimate decisions about what airs what is on their streaming service, what ideas get to be made. And they get to make the decisions about what's popular in the market at the moment and what they want to promote in the market. And that is not like most other industries. Like, if the airlines are jacking up prices and adding fees to everything, that's a financial decision that they are making to fuck over poor people and make them go into even more debt if they want to get on a flight. Like, that's a different issue than the people making our cultural content that informs our ideas about the country, informs our ideas about our own identities being in the country, and informs other people's ideas about what the US is about, what ideas we want to promote about ourselves. Like, the cultural identity in our media is being decided by a handful of fucking disgustingly rich people. And we're just allowing it because we have this kind of blind eye to all of these mergers and acquisitions and horizontal business moves. Like, we need to really think about, like, what do we want out of our cultural media and how do we get to that point? Because this is not fucking it. It's just not. If you look at something like Twitter, where Elon Musk has done the exact same thing, he has grown his business laterally in very fucking weird directions, but he has. And he acquired Twitter, and now it's a base for anti-Semitism, Nazis, just like general racism across the fucking platform. And it has grown exponentially into this very, very dangerous public forum area because an obscenely rich man with his own political ideas and powers to fucking influence wars in other countries, like, he just decided one day that this is what he was going to do with all of his money that he acquired from lateral business acquisitions and corruption and severe fucking employment practices, abuses. He used all of that money to buy a cultural sector. And some people might think that that's not a big deal, but it really fucking is. And it influences so much of our public consciousness and our ideas about who we are as a people, and has made me severely depressed thinking about it over the last year that he's owned Twitter, almost a year. And that's what we're looking at with our entertainment media as well, with these streamers acquiring other studios, buying them up, shutting them down, pushing independence out of the business. Like, we need to address it. And thankfully, the Assistant Attorney General, the AAG of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, he is Jonathan Cantor, and he has a real passion for fixing all of this shit with all of these things. So he's looking into Disney right now with the antitrust lawsuit from November of last year that I mentioned earlier. He's looking into the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger to review whether we should have done that and if it needs to be broken up, that I also mentioned earlier. And he's looking into the calls from some senators and representatives for thinking about Hollywood again, of like, what can we do to fix some of these issues so that four fucking filthy rich people don't own all of our cultural media again. So, like, in so many ways, it's like financial decisions and workers' rights decisions and cultural philosophical decisions that we need to make. We need to really, really address these questions of what kind of a nation do we want to be? And do we feel comfortable with the level of control and independence on international scales that these, like, obscenely rich people have just because they are obscenely rich? Like, that's the real crux of all of this that I keep banging on about. Yeah, Simon.
No, sorry, I was just gonna ask. So we started this episode by talking about the writer's strike, and we've been kind of going through that as well, and you just mentioned about possible action from the antitrust action from the Assistant General, I think it was it Assistant General, sorry?
Jonathan Cantor.
Yeah.
Assistant Attorney General of the Antitrust Division, Jonathan Cantor.
So is it more likely that it's going to be action from someone like him, or the market playing out in certain ways, which means that, you know, certain streamers decide to, you know, cut loss and not have streaming services, and we kind of get United services as a result of that. Is it more likely to come from either an action lawsuit like that, or from the market changing events, rather than from the actual WGA strike itself, which is, I'm guessing, primarily more focused on things like the working conditions and maybe paychecks and use of AI and things like that?
So it's never going to be just one. All of these things have to happen together. Like, the WGA put out this report recently. This is why we're talking about this right now specifically, because the WGA put out a report called The New Gatekeepers, talking about Amazon, Disney, and Netflix and their vertical integration and their lateral acquisitions. So they're aware of this issue, but the WGA alone cannot address monopolization of Hollywood. Like, we need either the FCC or the DOJ or the Supreme Court by some fucking miracle. Like, we need a lawsuit that's going to prompt this, this kind of antitrust action. And we need one of these divisions to kind of step up and start establishing some rules, whatever's in their jurisdiction to do. Simultaneously, we need the writers and SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild, we need them to win this strike, and we need them to win it dramatically. Like, we need the studios to be knocked down a few pegs. And the very disgusting thing about these strikes is that the studios are very happy to lose money. Very, very happy to lose money on this, because it's about subservience and it's about control. They have been quoted in the press, not even anonymously, like quoted in the press, saying it's unfortunate, but they really need to be homeless for us to win. Like, that's not even an exaggeration. They've said, we're just going to make this strike last long enough that the writers, whom we already pay a pittance and who really already are kind of homeless, a lot of them, or like live in flat shares of like 10 other people, or sleep on friends' couches. Like, that's the situation for a lot of writers in Hollywood. And the studios are like, yeah, make it worse. Like, I know we're in a period of intense inflation and the housing market's exorbitant and food prices are so high because of other monopolization fucking issues with grocery stores in the US, which is a whole other episode we could do. Like, the studios are actively saying, let them go further into poverty and eventually they will need jobs and they'll come crawling to us. Like, that's the stance that the studios are taking, and they're losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, like some in the millions, on these strikes. Hundreds of millions, I think, actually. I think WB just said that they lost $400 million because of the strikes directly. This summer alone, it's only been 4.5 months, and they've lost $400 million rather than paying the $43 million that the writers are asking for over like 3 years. Like, it's not even that much, but it's about subservience and control and keeping that money for their shareholders. Like, every dollar counts for the shareholders. So, like, these are the issues that we're having. It can't just be breaking up monopolization. It also has to be labor regulations. And that was an issue after the Paramount decrees as well, because once the Paramount decrees happened and the studios lost all of their money, they were like, oh, well, then we're not hiring people. Like, because they used to hire people on contracts of up to 7 years. And you were just kind of owned by the studio, which was also fucked up in its own way, but it was consistent pay. You knew you were going to be paid. And after that, they were like, oh, well, then we'll only hire you for one movie at a time and we're going to knock your rates down. And that's why we had strikes in 1952 and 1960. Like, all of these things are intertwined and need to happen together. Labor rights, antitrust legislation, and the establishment of something new to combat the streaming service. Like, we have to actively be involved in this as consumers to make decisions that, one, coincide with what the striking workers are asking for, and two, are smart. Like, if you don't use a streaming service as much as you think you would, maybe delete it. Like, maybe cancel your subscription and stop giving them your money. Like, if you don't watch it every day or even every month, think about getting rid of your subscription. Even the legacy accounts that used to be like frozen price-wise, they're not anymore. Like, Hulu in the US is going up to $17.99 a month. $17.99 a month for Hulu. Like, that's fucking insane. And that doesn't even come with Disney Plus in the States. Like Simon said earlier, in the UK, we get both kind of bundled together because of just how it works here. In the States, it's going to be $13.99 for Hulu Plus, or for Disney Plus rather. So you're spending $14 and $18 for two streaming services every month. And that's just Disney and Hulu. So these are things that you can do. You can, if you're not using a streaming service, get rid of it. Just cancel that subscription. If you have the time in the next week after this episode goes up, by September 18th, please submit your comments on the merger regulations reviews. There are new proposed guidelines for how mergers will work on the DOJ website. You can find that link on my Twitter. It's in my pinned thread. And you can also follow along with the WGA and SAG-AFTRA and see what they're asking consumers to do throughout these strikes. So far, there isn't a call for boycotting streaming services, but that might be a tactic that is asked in the future. And if you support these strikes and you are listening to this episode, like, holy shit, what the fuck is going on with all of this? Why is this happening? And what can I do? Like, give that a think.
And if someone is somehow listening to this podcast and they aren't following you on Twitter or aware of who you might be, Vaughn, do you want to just give your Twitter name for this?
Yes, I'm at G Vaughn Joy. So GVAUGHNJOY on Twitter.
And of course, you can follow our Impressions of America Twitter account as well, which I think is at USA Impressions, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Sorry, was there anything else you wanted to add before we're closing?
No, ranting at this. I'm just mad about all of it. It's so frustrating, especially when we have two examples of antitrust actions in Hollywood and in the entertainment industry that have worked so well before. And like, it's not even just this issue. It's also kind of satellite television that's an issue too, because Dish, a couple days ago, just got rid of 37 main channels, including Disney and all of Disney's subsidiaries, because of a dispute about whether the studios are going to pay the satellite network anymore. The studios are essentially like, well, we don't really make that much money, so we shouldn't be like paying to be on your service anymore. So we're just not going to air ESPN anymore. And it's like, what? So actual like satellite television, which is not physical media, but is like the step between physical media and streaming, I guess, like that is about to crumble entirely and kind of just go away. And we're not really talking about that. Like, there are so many issues here that desperately need addressing. And I wish it would happen. And I will keep yelling about all of it until it does.
Indeed.
So I'm saying we can end anywhere. Just cut me off, because I'm going to keep ranting otherwise.
Okay. I will probably cut you off there then. There are a bunch of other things that we could talk about. We haven't even mentioned the fact that that actor strike is happening right now as well, of course. The impact that's having as far as the release of movies. And just a bunch of other things in relation to how the industry is trying to deal with this titanic shift in in media, in rights, in streaming, in pay and everything else. But that would probably be for another episode. Yes, we should probably finish up there. Vaughn, thank you as always for bringing a topic to us and allowing such interesting discussion. I'm glad we got a really kind of interesting and off the moment topic to discuss for our first episode back. So thank you for that.
Got you.
And Toby, thank you as always. I'm just very upset that we had to. And we weren't recording when I was asking you about Nas and Jay-Z, because that was probably the most interesting part of this recording. But that's when
I learned a lot of new things on this episode, really. It was like a moment when like Simon was saying something, I was like, what? That can't be true. Yeah.
It's just because I lie a lot. That's all that is. Right. Okay. We should probably finish up there. Yes, thanks, Toby. Thanks, Vaughn. Fantastic to be back podcasting with you guys. I've missed a lot, so hopefully we'll have another episode again done within, 9 months or something since we last did one. So we should probably get another one episode out in a much shorter time frame for you. Not quite sure when that will be, but hopefully it'll be relatively soon. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and take care. All the best. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.